every single time. I got to do it. I can't help it. Space Toast with the Groove.
It's a great song, though,
gentlemen,
to get all excited about. You know what I'm saying?
This is Nick and Josh.
Yeah,
this
no, welcome back. This time we're just here.
We are back. Episode number 48. No, taking a dump and thinking about shit.
I think the intros are getting worse, frankly.
Well, it's, you know, if you, it's because you interrupted my beatboxing there.
I did, yeah.
And listen, those fans of ours, I've gotten letters about the beatboxing.
Emails.
And how in fact that they really, really appreciate not only my beatboxing ability, but my actual musical talent. I don't know if you've known this, Joshua, but I have been called the songbird of my generation.
This is a podcast where we solve all the world's problems, I think.
Sometimes, except for my singing.
We might need to solve our own problems first, but really, who cares about that? We're solving the world's problems.
That's right.
What's happening, my friend?
You know, a little tiki-tiki here.
Way sooner than last time.
Yeah. This is like a week and a half. This is we're working on this, guys.
We're back in the original home base of Todatus. Newish but oldish set of my garage this time.
In the Casa de Juswa, I'm drinking a little Four Roses. Juswa's drinking a little white wine. We're classing it up a little bit today. That's why I keep calling him Juswa. It's his French name.
I am drinking white wine.
It's a French.
I got my pinky up and everything.
Yeah.
I think I broke my pinky. But
what a week.
What a fantastic, man, we had lots of stuff going on this week. Mostly sitting around my birthday. Big game.
Mr. 4-4 this year. We didn't do this on your birthday, but this is kind of in honor of your birthday.
Close enough. I think it's probably closer.
So you know what? We're gonna stop this, restart the whole thing, and we have to focus the title. It says Abraham Lincoln Assassination
ALA.
Episode 48.
Yeah, we should try some numerology and see if we can tie that in there. Yeah, I told her.
For your 44th, it's our 48th, and it's Abraham Lincoln.
I told my oldest, I was like, yeah, we're going to do for Abraham Lincoln Assassination Day. And she's like, what? I said, we usually celebrate it with cake every year.
Just a piece of cake.
Coincides with my birthday, but yeah, it was a whole thing. We'll get into that probably later. But man, how you been? It's been, I saw you a couple days ago, but for the rest of them, it's been a little while.
Podcast's been about a week. You know, we started with sports. We can pick right back up with sports. Listen, the Rockets are in the playoffs.
It's a fun time for sports in Houston. Yeah,
H-Town, the youngsters, they are locked down the number 2 seed. They are setting up to play Golden State starting tomorrow.
Like, what are the thoughts around, like, okay, you know, you're in the playoffs, obviously. You're in the number 2 seed, so there's, like, home court advantage all the way through until the Western Conference Finals, you know, if you face
the number 1, yeah.
Oklahoma City. But you draw... You draw Golden State, the nemesis of Houston. Golden State, like, I think they even asked Fred Van Fleet today, like, you know, what do you think about the fans' nervousness? And his response was something like, that's not this team, which I appreciate that. And he wasn't here, so, of course, that's all I can say. But as a fan, it's got to be in your head, right, in some way, shape, or form.
I'll tell you, the only thing that's in my head is this. Last night, when Golden State went on to win to be the team that gets to play the Rockets, right?
I don't have
cable, but I did see via Twitter/X, right, the highlights, and none other than fucking the greatest shooter, 3-point shooter of all time. Tip my cap, give the flowers. Listen, fuck Steph Curry, went Steph Curry in the fourth quarter.
Yeah,
pump faking motherfuckers. I mean, you name it, just dropping threes left, right.
Does that bore you at all? Like,
no, I'm thoroughly impressed. That's my angst. Is that guy?
He can get up.
Fuck Golden State. That guy's the problem.
But
do
you think that's a series? Like that you're worried about him for a series, or is it like we got, you know, there's a game or two where he may get loose? Like I don't know. Like I don't follow basketball, so like I'm gonna say is really ignorant. But like I'm not worried about Golden State in the way that team, that franchise has I really decimated the Rockets in the playoffs in like some really, you know.
Sure, no, fair, in all fairness, I was not privy to the Fred VanVleet comment, but I love the answer because I think it is beyond apropos, right?
What else could you say?
That's not the same team. That's not this team, right? Yeah. The team that lost to them was the Chris Paul hamstring away from an NBA championship, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a James Harden era. That was this. There's a bunch of things happened, right? 27 fucking missed threes in the same game. All of that is not relevant for this squad with the Warriors.
Nobody on this team was on that team.
Right.
I mean, it was a different owner back then.
Well, all I'm saying flat out is the reason all my angst is Steph Curry. Like, unguardable.
It
shoots from everywhere.
It was literally a different team. It was a different owner, different management, different coach, different players. It was a completely different team. So there is something, you know, I do like that for Fred VanVleet. Like, you know,
I love that as an answer. Like, but my anxious, my only answer to anxious is it's Curry.
Yeah.
And Curry is always the angst. I mean, it's there are superstars that you have to try and contain. He's one of them. That's it.
Yeah, but like even if he goes off, I don't think that he can beat you.
Well, the rest of the team isn't the same for sure, right? He doesn't have Clay anymore. He's got Draymond's dirty ass. But, right, but I mean, they're like not the same either.
The grand scheme of things, I don't think that he like he beats you. I don't think that he wins four games in the series. Handicapping, like, you know, obviously seven games. What, like, how do you think Rockets in seven? That'd be
doesn't even need to be that many.
I think it needs to be five or six. Or
well, and I saw as soon as I saw the announcement matchup announced, you know, obviously whichever homer it was on X. Rockets in six. Sure, listen, I want the Rockets to win. I don't care if it's four, five, or six. I don't care if it's seven. Do I have a thought on it? Do I have a thought on it?
Yeah, I care if it's
I
seven.
I don't. Actually, I don't because I'm not going to be able to watch it except for at work.
I think you're you know, we're going to start a new counter every time you mention you don't have cable because it's like.
It's disappointing to me. This is one of the things.
We can tell.
Working on that.
I think.
Started GoFundMe.
I think. Let me see if I can find it. Golden State, I think, is favored in the series, which, you know, it makes sense when you kind of – yeah, I know that the Rockets had a fantastic season, but, I mean, it's a bunch of young kids who are largely untested, and
sure.
It's Golden State, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. No, I
so, like, I understand that, but, yeah, I think – you know, I think Rockets going to win this series. I hope it doesn't go to seven because if it goes to seven, to me, there's a stress level that I'm not really as a fan not really interested in. But also I think that this team, you know, I think it'd be a big boost of confidence to kind of like go out there and smoke Golden State. You know?
Sure.
And it's not, of course, it's not the same Golden State. They can say the same thing. It's not the same team as back, you know, back in those
Right, but I understand
days.
What you're saying. Like, it's just like the monkey. You can get the monkey off your back, even though it's not necessarily on this Rockets team, but there is the Warriors are the monkey on the Rockets' back.
Yeah. I mean, I think –
metaphorically, yeah.
I think there's a really – realistic and maybe even probable chance this team's playing in a Western Conference final, and you know, at that point it's just, you know, let's just go get it, right? You know what I mean? Like, it is what it is. Put it all out there.
It's very doable for this team because this. I mean, they didn't accident their way into the number two seed. They didn't. I mean, for what it's worth, neither did Oklahoma City.
Sure.
And it was a couple weeks back, two podcasts back, I guess. I was telling you that I messaged my buddy in Oklahoma about the Thunder and. You know, I hadn't even realized at that point there were 74 games in the season.
I know.
And fucking they had lost 12 times. Holy shit. And we were number two by a mile, and we're 12 games behind them. Yep. Like, holy fuck, dude.
Yeah, it was a pretty amazing season for them. You know, we talked about this in the last podcast. You know, it's a touch of a goofy thing that with regard to Americans, how you know, how we crown our champion, like that, all that regular season stuff is like completely thrown out. Yeah, you've got some seeding and you've got a couple of different, you know, things that the regular season, you know, how that works out. But, you know, just throw it all out. Throw the regular season out. You got matchups, you got
the relevance,
home court advantage and all that. But, I mean, it's all out the window.
Right, the relevance and the record of what you did versus team during regular season. It does no longer count, which is what I think you're trying to say there, and I agree.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
It's just like Golden State. Like Golden State can come in seventh, and they're the favorite going into the playoffs because of their pedigree and history and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and that's the like I would say that's both the beauty and the silly of American playoff style because it does put reverence and it gives credence to what you did all year. However, it's a completely new season. And it's what matters the most. It's where the champions are you know they're for. It's where you fucking. The diamonds actually come out of that pressure, right?
There you go. Yeah. Astros. Ugh.
They're on a slide. But you know what? The game that I went to with Kevin and Jamie. Thank you, Kevin and Jamie, for taking this. They
who
won.
Who pitched that day? Forget.
Wisenberger, Wisniewski. That guy.
Wisniewski, yeah. Local guy. I think he's going to turn out to be a pretty good player.
Hey, listen. He went six full. Gave up three solo home runs. Five total hits. And struck out 10.
That's kind of his MO so far this season. He's just kind of giving up a big hit here and there. His first start out, I think he went like six, struck out like eight or nine, and Astros blew a save late. So
if he's gone two quality starts to come out and he's got 18 strikeouts, and I was impressed with the 10 Ks in six innings. You know, when we were at the game, it was literally, listen, you gave up three solo home runs. You gave up a total of five hits. I was annoyed inning one and inning two because you gave up the home run, second pitch of the first inning, and, like, first pitch of the second. I was like, dude, get this guy out of here. And then he was just, like, it made me forget. Yeah, honestly, the first home run made me forget that he struck out the next two outs we got, or two of those outs were strikeouts. Yeah. Same thing the second inning. All right, and then you start seeing him starting to deal.
Those home runs were in the first inning?
The first, he gave up one in the first, one in the second, and, like, one in the fifth.
I got you. Okay. So I think that was his home debut. He's from Cyfair School, yeah. So you know, there's some extra adrenaline
nerves there, sure.
On the air, but I think if he's your number five and he's pitching like that, you know, the rotation would be pretty solid. You had
any more word on old Sassy Lance? I haven't heard anything.
Yeah, he's let's see.
He was still Sugarland, right?
Yeah. He's doing a bunch of rehab kind of assignments. I forget what I read yesterday about it, but he's getting close to join the Major League Club, and they brought up a guy today. What's his name? Irk. Forget now. So, the rotation seems to be pretty solid. The middle of the rotation, we'll see. Hunter Brown was lights out.
Yeah, Hunter Brown, didn't he get American League Pitcher of the Week or Pitcher of the Month or something?
That wouldn't surprise me. His numbers really, are ridiculous to deal with. Yeah, he's really, really, really pitching like he wants to be an ace of a team. Fromber has been a little Frombery. Some good stuff mixed in with, you know.
Yeah, so when he does that, I like to call him Flambeau.
Yeah, he's...
very Flambeau.
You know, sometimes he's like Fromber, and sometimes he's like Fromber. Yeah. You know what I mean? When he's good, he's really good. And he got touched up a little bit, I think, yesterday.
Yeah, he gave a bunch yesterday.
I think the Astros are sitting at 7-11 right now. So they're not like crazy. A couple games out of first place. It's been an interesting, you know, go in the AL. The
West.
AL West.
Yeah,
AL
West.
Sorry, got distracted looking at the game. But, I think the pitching is going to be good. I think the biggest disappointment for the Astros right now is their first baseman.
Christian Walker.
Yeah. Like, he was on paper set up to be, like, you know, the solve. You know, we went through Abreu. You know, we had whatever. After Yuli, Gurriel, I think the Astros are trying to find that lockdown, you know.
Bat.
Stud
just a bat.
They can mash 30 home runs.
Well, because defensively they haven't had really a problem at first base.
I mean, first base is a position that, it, you know, you can hide some defensive.
Yeah, fair.
Christian Walker's a gold glove defender. So, like, you're getting that plus 35 home runs.
Yeah, except
he's
for
he was
over
250,
four today,
somewhere in that range. But he's going to slug. He's just been really disappointing. I'm like garbage level this year, and it's really the biggest hole. I'll tell you what. Jake Myers has been a breath of fresh air. He's got pop. He is playing gold glove center fielder. I think his stats right now are like the best center fielder.
So the game I was at, I know these numbers after the fact. Keep going. Keep going.
Well, I was just going to say that like that has been a guy that I didn't really count on to add this much offense.
Sure.
So, you know, that's really a breath of fresh air. Cam Smith is hanging in there. You know, there's a question whether he's going to get bounced down. He's batting around 200. And if you're sitting at 200 as a rookie, and you're having good at bats, you're having good swings, I think they let him play.
And Isak Paredes is doing good. He's doing well.
We saw his stats compared to Bregman a couple days ago. Now,
Bregman's off yesterday. 5 for 5, couple home runs yesterday.
Yeah, he went off yesterday. But before that, their numbers were very comparable. Very comparable.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say about Jake Myers is the game I was at, obviously during the game, I can't, you know, see the live stats. And they do they do that catch percentage. When the fielder makes a good play, like the actual percentage chance that they would make the catch and right. or they rate it 5-star or whatever.
Okay.
Jake
they
Myers.
Do that on the Jumbotron?
No, they didn't do it on the Jumbotron. I saw it on Twitter X later.
Oh, okay.
And the stat was that it was like a 33 or 32% chance that the normal fielder would make that catch that Jake did.
Right. So he's,
above it. You know, it was like a 4-star catch or something because he came in hauling ass and then fucking dove, slid at it, got it. It was beautiful.
Yeah. I'm with you. He's been really a breath of fresh air at center field, both playing gold glove defense, but like maybe more importantly, like putting the ball in play, putting pop, drawn walks. He's a threat when he gets on base to steal, and you know it's exactly what you want out of your center fielder, and it's kind of not that it came out of nowhere. I think when you saw that Jake had some of these tendencies, you know what I mean. It's just like. With the injury he had a couple of years ago, just we're trying to see him come all the way back. And man, early
you know,
on,
one of my,
like
one of my favorite funny things to say about Jake Myers, old rake there, when he's on, and I mean this, and I would challenge you and anybody that listens to this to just pay attention and tell me I'm crazy. I am crazy, but when he's on, when he hits well, and he's doing specifically having a good game in the batter's box, I feel like his helmet fits better on those days and those at bats than the days that he struggles. And by that I mean when he swings. Sometimes, like when he's off, his helmet will almost come off. When he's running, his helmet will damn near fall off, except for the days that he's on. It's like he has a different helmet. It's the best I can figure.
Let's keep our eyes peeled for that. That's an interesting call out. I don't know. I saw him steal second base the other day, and his helmet fell off, so I don't know what that means.
Did he walk? Well, who knows how he got there. But
I don't know.
What I was going to say also, last little thing here sports-wise, I played golf today with Larson. Some bitch beat me. But golf-wise, we had – this past weekend we had the Masters. And congratulations to Rory McIlroy for completing the career grand slam. And tie back to baseball is there's a one of the most iconic pictures of his victory now. And I mean, it's there's a bunch of them out there, but there's one specifically that has photo credits to Ken Griffey Jr. Because
yeah,
Ken Griffey Jr. is now doing photography, sports
good
photography.
For him. That's
and
fun.
The beauty of it is, though, that people took that and they were like, you know, Cincinnati Reds paid this photographer $3.5 million last year.
Yeah, it was a funny it was a funny meme that they took one of his pictures and said that kind of pitched it as he was a photographer that Cincinnati Reds paid $3 million. There's a handful of contracts from the 90s that are just still going on. Bobby Bonilla,
yeah,
Ken Griffey Jr. Like they're just still getting paid, and God bless those guys for getting those contracts. That's absolutely amazing. We buried the lead though, so we're gonna switch to the most important thing that happened today. I played this song for you earlier.
Yeah, that's screaming as a bunch of
English people. It probably feels like that at the stadium, but we're watching the game now, the replay. But, man, I tell you what, the boys, Arsenal won a pretty dramatic and amazing kind of, I don't know, amazing for me, obviously, but beating Real Madrid in the fashion they did. They won the first leg 3-0, pretty much smoked them. Come back to the Bernabeu. I don't know if you know that's what the stadium's called. It's called the Bernabeu. It's a famous stadium that Real Madrid play. And there was this word. I have to look it up. Rotunda. Anyways, and it meant comeback. And so that was kind of the mantra of the game. And there was no comeback whatsoever. Arsenal, you know, they were up 3-0 going into the second leg of the aggregate. And
that's what I was about to say. So it shows the score up there, and it shows there's a score of the game, and then there's off to the right, and
right.
The aggregate score. So
right.
This is game two.
Yeah, in the Champions League, similar to how we might have a three-game series in American sports.
They do home and home?
They have a two-game home and away, right? So you play at their place, you play at our place kind of thing. And the winner is most goals scored over those two games. So Arsenal goes up 3-0 in the first game, and, you know, at this level, that's going
to
be tough.
So hold on. So just to clarify, the winner is determined based on the aggregate score. So if I win the first game 5-0,
uh-huh.
but I lose the second game 1-0, I still win both games?
No, you move on.
Okay.
So if you win the game 5-0 the first leg and you lose the game 4-0 the next leg, you still move on. It's combined goals is what it goes by.
Okay.
So, you know, obviously if you win both games, you move forward because you can't.
Correct. Gotcha. Right. Yeah. Right.
But I mean, think about that. So think about that. It's most goals scored moves on. And for example, Arsenal's leading 3-0 at this point in the game as you're watching, but say Real Madrid scores the three goals to tie, then the game is the round is tied.
Yeah, yeah.
So you'll play extra time and then penalty kicks potentially.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that's kind of how that works out. That being said, a three-goal lead, even going to their place, is pretty astronomical at this level. And, you know, you get a whole week to strategize, and, you know, there's a whole idea about what's called parking the bus. Arsenal didn't do that necessarily. They ended up winning the game 2-1. And a pretty... I don't know, I would call it impressive fashion. And what I mean by that, like, they didn't back away from the challenge. There's a kid in the field for Arsenal, Miles Lewis-Skelly, who, I mean, just continues to impress. He's 18 years old. He's playing against the biggest – I mean, this is the biggest stars in all of world soccer. Mbappe's on the field. Vinicius Jr.'s on the field. I mean, this is, like, the best of the best. And
yeah, I saw Mbappe flip my top, that guy.
Yeah. That should be his song, by the way. Mbappe, I think it's how you pronounce it, but this 18-year-old like stood up, you know, again against some of the hardest competition in the world, and like played like a beast, and I think this might be actually a joke or a meme, but there was something that I saw. So there was an altercation earlier in the season with Manchester City and Arsenal, and Manchester City ends up scoring a late goal to tie, and Manchester City's player Erling Haaland, their forward, scores all the goals, break the record for goal scoring, so on and so forth. On his way, I think after the game, told Mikel Arteta, the manager for Arsenal, to stay humble, right? And it was a big slight.
So the player told the manager to stay humble,
right? And it was also after a late goal tie, right? It was one of those like shit talking things.
So he scored the goal and then tells the opposing team manager to stay humble.
Stay humble. That's kind of the thing, right? So that became a bit of a mantra. And so the next time Arsenal played against Manchester City, we beat them 5-1, and the 18-year-old scored a goal, and he did that Erling Haaland's goal celebration.
Oh yeah, I remember you talking about.
So again, I haven't seen this attributed to him, but if it's true, it's amazing. But after the game, they were asking about, like, you know, how did you perform this big level? This, you know, this is the biggest, whatever. You're 18-year-old.
Humble.
And he said, somebody early in the season just told us to stay humble, and we listened to it. And it's like, again, I haven't substantiated. I'm saying that because somebody said that was BS. But, man, oh, man, if that's true, what a ballsy and clever and, I mean, 18-year-old, you know, talking shit and backing it up, you know.
Yeah.
And, like, it's that backup element that – you know, that's super impressive. But, yeah, huge win. This is as far as Arsenal's been in this tournament in, I think, 20 years. There's a – Saka scores just an amazing goal, Nick. We'll see it here in a little bit. But he does Thierry Henry's, like, shush the crowd celebration, which Thierry Henry did in this stadium 20 years ago or so against this team. Arsenal has a very shallow history with Real Madrid. We beat him a couple times, one time with – Thierry Henry, and so we'll pause and I'll show it to you. But there's a you know, one of these kind of thing,
nice,
celebration,
yeah.
And it's like, you know, there's a link to that.
Well, like how you referred, just said though, that we're bearing the lead. This is the amount of passion that Josh has for soccer. By the way, folks, I have for both golf and MMA, and I'm quietly over here. You hear me now? Like,
yeah,
talking in the library.
It was a big thing. my kids bought me a new Arsenal polo that I wore at work today. We were doing our meeting and I was watching the game, and it was pretty intense.
You know what a great segue. I wanted to talk to you earlier about this too. Sorry, tell me about your polo, and then we'll talk about Josh Reddick.
That's his uniform. Looks good.
Well, so tell me about your polo, and then we'll talk about Reddick.
Well, no, I mean, I mean, the story is I got a polo, but I think I'll do this real quick. I just want to talk about the experience we had at the Astros game too. Like, it was my birthday was Monday, Nick, and we had.
Did you go to the 14-3 game? Did we win the game? She sang out or no?
Say again.
Did the Astros win the game that she sang out?
No. So
that was the day before. That was like 14-3. You were at like a 6-1 loss or something.
Yeah. I forget the score, but the story is my youngest daughter and her choir got invited to sing the national anthem at the Astros game. And so we made a family trip out of it, and all five of us went to the game. And I'll tell you what, Nick, it was one of the best baseball experiences I've had in a long, 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 long time. And the reason is that my youngest and my middle were just, like, enamored with everything that was going on and just so inquisitive. Just, like, they wanted to know everything about the nuance of what was going on in the stadium. And I just really enjoyed kind of explaining that to them and kind of unpacking baseball in a way. You know, this is something.
Sure, yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah,
we
talk about soccer as a passion of mine, but baseball is probably, you know, it's 1A and 1B. I don't know, baseball is always like held a special, like, something with me. I don't know about playing it, I don't know about experiencing it, I don't know about the idea of, like, I follow the Astros, you know, even when they were really, really bad. I just love the whole thing of it. And my girls, a couple of them played softball, but, like, just the nuance of baseball is just kind of a bit of a blind spot to them. And they were just so into it. And it just was the most pleasurable experience. I mean, like, you could not, like something that you're interested in for your kids to actually get into it. That's like one of the highest levels.
Sure.
It was that,
no,
it was
absolutely
that. And then, like, the inquisitiveness, the curiousness, and the, you know what I mean? It was
getting to share all, not just the experience, but the knowledge and the depth of it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, and I think I taught you guys, you and Larson learned something from my baseball knowledge as well about Craig Biggio's Sunshine Kid.
So it was just
amazing experience.
What I was going to say back to it was awesome, by the way. I'm not just missing Josh Reddick. So the other night, two nights ago, whatever, a couple games back, he looked like a fucking homeless person. He had it was like 4 days worth of beard growth, and if he had wet his hair, like he didn't look like he showered and combed it. It looked like he just may have dunked his head, possibly in a toilet.
Yeah.
And then the suit he was wearing
I got a better one. His suit looked like when he was playing with the Astros, Carlos Correa left his suit at his house. And he was like, I'm just going to wear this today. It looked like a suit that was for a guy 4 inches taller than him.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no tie. And the scraggly. He looked terrible.
Yeah.
And then the next day, clean shaven, good fucking combed, you know, clean hair, combed up, and a nice tailored three-piece suit like he's wearing tonight.
Yeah, it makes you wonder.
It's like, what the fuck, dude?
There's also, like, you know, man, I hope he's, like, trolling. Like, I hope that, like, famous people have a sense of humor and they like, get trolling and they get, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's
It's like we talked about when we talked about Trump and Zelensky showing up, like, not wearing a suit, whatever. It's like, dude, he'd have looked better if he was wearing a fucking track suit, because That suit he had on was terrible.
It was no bueno, for sure.
Carlos Correa, it's apt because Correa was definitely much taller than him. Like, I don't know how big he is.
It
but
just
he,
seemed like, it seemed like Big Brother's suit or dad. You said dad's suit.
Dad's suit, yeah. Something and like no that, tie. Yeah. Like, it just was. I can deal with the facial hair and I can deal with the fucked up hair, but, like, the suit itself just drove me nuts. And then we have no tie. Yeah, and you're wearing every other piece of the suit and buttoned up.
Yeah.
Why? Why, dude?
Yeah.
If you're going to do that, do flip flops, please.
I think for me, it was that. He knows how to dress. You know what I mean? Like, I've seen him look good in a suit. Like, he knows how to wear a suit. And it was like, man, did you just... But again, like, were you sleeping 20 minutes before you went on wear?
You're wearing a custom tailored three-piece suit today.
Yeah, man. That was interesting.
What was that thing? Yeah, you know, like you said, were you sleeping 20 minutes ago? Like, were you in your car? Did you pass out drunk?
It was almost, another option. Like, maybe somebody bailed on that show that night. Like, hey, can you do it? And he's like, yeah, but.
He's like, I don't have a suit. And we've got one of Blummers here. He's like, fuck it, I can wear a Blummer suit.
Yeah. All right, I got an idea. Let's take a little break, and then we'll be right back.
Do it. We got a refreshed beverage.
We're good to go.
Refreshed beverage.
Right on.
Tinkle
right
break. On. Nobody went tinkle. We made a beverage and we were chatting.
So we're going to come back and talk about a book that I've read a couple times that you're engaging in now. And, man, I think that this book is so interesting for, like, I think the narrative shattering that it provides. And also, like, man, I mean, I don't know. I bought it by way of it satisfied for me the journalistic integrity that, you know what I mean, would otherwise. So anyways, the book's called Chaos.
Yeah, the book's called
Chaos. This is about the Manson murders. So I don't know, you're into a little more now. You want to
years ago, I got Helter Skelter, Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecuting attorney for the Charles Manson family murders in the 70s, the Tate LaBianca murders. He wrote the book, Helter Skelter, and as far as I knew, and as far as most people I've ever spoken to and addressed about it, right, their knowledge of the Manson family and Manson family murders is directly tied or directly correlated greatly to the narrative of Helter Skelter.
Yeah, I mean, Bugliosi was the prosecuting attorney, and I think
he is the New York Times best-selling author, the authority on this.
I think that
subject.
Book is the number one selling or number one sold true crime book. It is the number one seller in the genre also. So
sure.
Not only is it like it is considered the official narrative, but also like it's been widely read, and it was also it came out relatively close to after the murder, so it has been kind of the standard bearer for what happened from the horse's mouth, you know what I mean? And so, you know, you experienced that book in a way that, like, I guess that was what happened. And so we first started talking about this subject. I was like, man, I read this book that really, like, changes the narrative on Manson. And you and I remember having conversations. You're like, well, this is what I learned. This is what I learned. I was like, well, this is what I learned. So anyways, I challenge you to read the book, I guess, whatever. Like, hey, and that's where we are, right? And so, I mean, I guess, I don't know, questions, answers, like...
As far as Chaos goes, like, when I started reading it, you were telling me, you know, it is a counter-narrative, or it challenges, challenges the narrative of Helter Skelter, specifically, as Bugliosi described Helter Skelter, was the intent for Manson and the Manson family was to go in and kill these white people and make it look like they were done by Black Panthers to try to instigate a race war, and the plan was to have the race war kick off, and then him and his followers were going to go live at Spawn Ranch in the desert out there where they did, while the rest of society killed each other in a race war, and then he and his followers were going to rise to power. That was the narrative as it was explained via Bugliosi for the motive, if you will, for both the Tate and LaBianca murders.
I don't think the Manson or the family like challenged that narrative necessarily. You know what I mean? Like I don't know if they ever said no, that's not what we're, you know what I'm saying. So it wasn't necessary. Like that was widely accepted. Like,
well, and so when it came to the prosecution of it, I knew that Manson himself had acted as his own attorney on purpose. For varying reasons in my own opinion, but hearing Bugliosi talk about it now in Chaos talk about it, right, again, when you're your own attorney, right, when you represent yourself, then all discovery, you're subject to see the prosecution's case. You can see all the evidence, you can see everything that's being presented against you. And if you are someone a la Ted Bundy who wanted to relive it and enjoy the fucking goriness and hell, even, you know, jack off on the pictures, whatever.
Is that what you think he represented himself?
Well, Manson, as I heard it from in Chaos, and as I thought it beforehand, was there was a level of appreciation of what you did, and or knowing what they quote unquote were going to bring as their case, and not necessarily like concern one way or the other about being convicted, because also understanding, as I act as my own attorney at some point, right? Because I'm not, because I didn't go to law school. Like they'll tell you when you act as your own attorney, you'll hear judges say that that's, you know, this is not grounds for a case to be dismissed or whatever. But what he did, the reason the judge actually made him stop, he no longer allowed him to represent himself, because Manson was doing the other side, which was objecting to every fucking thing and writing ridiculous fucking motions. He was right. In Chaos, in the chapter eight or nine, talks about. He said Manson filed somewhere north of fucking 75 motions, and they were just absurd. Everything from the reason that this case should be dismissed, something in effect, and I'm just spitballing, making up, like, you know, I didn't get enough dessert, or I'm not allowed this, or this, and I mean, just everything and anything that he could file a motion for, because by the letter of the law, you can file a motion for pretty much anything. So he was doing stuff like that. Like, it was part of the game, as I understood it, or as I've read it so far. But the other part is, you can, they will say it. The judges, you'll hear them when somebody's acting their own attorney, this is not going to be grounds later for dismissing the case or whatever, because
you can't use misrepresented attorney.
I didn't have good legal representation. That
so it's my kind of thought, and I just got
that's
done,
the first part of it, by the way.
I just got done reading a book called The Acid Alchemist about this guy named John Haigh, something like that. I think he was in England, operating in England. He basically would sulfuric acid maybe is his he read something somewhere that he interpreted as, if there's no body, there's no crime. And so he's like, well, if I disintegrate the bodies, then they can never. And so
to an extent, you can't prove murder without a fucking dead body. I mean,
yeah, but that was, by the way, that was proven not to be true, and there's all kinds of evidence you can't, anyways.
I understand that. Yes,
but I guess the point I'm trying to make is, I think there's an element of, if Bundy represented himself, I forget now, but this guy did, that there's a certain elegance and
trying to beat the system, systems on purpose.
Well, but I think arrogance combined with, like, you know, the idea of their intellectual capability, right?
Yeah.
These people, I don't mean to say they're all the exact same, but the particular people that commit these crimes that want to commit, defend themselves, I think there's an element of, like, arrogance around, like, I know better than any lawyer could ever know. You know what I mean? Like,
it's part of the game. Yeah.
There's a point about, like, you know, I'm outsmarting.
Yeah.
That being said, in this Acid Alchemist, there's a point where they're like, that's not true. He ends up confessing, and this guy is so something that, you know, he knows he's going to be hung. He knows he's going to be executed. And what is that? What is the? I think it's French Wax Museum, Marie something. You know what I'm talking about?
You're talking about Madame Tussauds?
There you go. Madame, not Marie. The famous wax, whatever. They were going to do a wax statue of him, and they were, you know, asking if he can provide something for it. And the guy sent, like, a press shirt, his favorite suit, and with instructions, like, you know,
how he wanted to be wearing it.
Yeah, like the kind of haircut that he wanted. You know what I mean? Like that's the arrogance of this guy. He confessed to murdering these people, and he was, you know, facing his maker. And, you know, like, his the most important thing in his life was that, you know, he was remembered in this wax museum. You know, he like, I take care of myself. I'm a Dapper Dan. You know,
nice.
Make sure my hair is parted in the right way, and, you know, so on and so forth. That's super interesting. But, like, I guess the ultimate thing is he defended himself as well. And, like there's something about, you know, I don't know, like, misperceived intelligence, or, like, that conception of I'm smarter than everybody.
Sure.
That I think, to me, that seems to drive that element of defending yourself.
Also, and, like I said, and it's at some point you could try to use that as a grounds for dismissal of a case for whatever. But so when it Chaos, though, back into that, like, Manson, what I knew of Manson and Buglossi and Helter Skelter before reading Chaos, where I'm at with Chaos now and 10 chapters in, it seems... I would describe Chaos as a direct contradictory narrative to Helter Skelter. He's not trying to say, I don't feel like the author is literally trying to say that Buglossi or anyone in these stories has lied. It's not that at all. It's that there are so many things that have been omitted from their details in interviews. There's details in witness statements. There are there are facts. There are timelines. There are evidentiary.
There's questions.
There's evidentiary just errors. Things that are. One of the ones popped in my head. I was thinking it's not even an error. It's Charles Manson was on federal parole, and even while subpoenaed in by during trial for his life. Right, so you're on trial for with the death penalty. The defense attorney asked the U.S. Attorney's Office for his probation or his parole file, the whole file, which is supposedly 4 inches thick. They sent 69 pages with things redacted and marked out, even to his own attorney. Mm-hmm. He was not allowed to actually get his own full parole. He was not allowed to get his client's full parole file with all the information about it.
Which is something.
It's weird. Yeah. And it's the same thing I was saying when we were talking about this a minute ago. Is it seems like Manson was protected on high from the Prince of Darkness. He was arrested while on federal parole for drug possession, weapon possession, driving a stolen vehicle. Goes to jail, has underage girls with him that are on drugs. Goes to jail, and the whole family goes to jail. They're all there for 3 days, and then they're all released. And this didn't happen once or twice. It happened multiple times.
Like three strikes, you're out.
All
like
over
19,
California.
This is 19 strikes.
Well, he's supposed to leave San Francisco, and he's in L.A., and he didn't ask to be transferred. They just said, oh, I guess he's transferred. And then we were talking earlier, his probation officer, parole officer, from this program where it was, regular to intense. He's the only parole guy.
To me, I don't think the author set out to dispute or dismiss or like really even say anything about Helter Skelter. I think, as the author described, his original task was to write an article about the 30th anniversary of it.
Yeah.
And so he started to dig in, and it was like he just kept get presented with questions. Like, to me, there's an element of okay, he got away with a bunch of these things, right? And then we also talked about, I don't know if we on air or not, but the elements of the story we're told about what the purpose of doing this crime, these murders in this way, was to otherwise elicit a race war,
which that never made sense to me from the beginning.
Well, okay, it doesn't make sense. Maybe in the elements of how these people are involved in it, so on and so forth. But if you think about, if you go super conspiracy and go, okay, well, this was some kind of, obviously he was given time after time to, if it's minimum, they just kept him in society to wreak havoc.
Sure.
You know what I mean? That may be one element. But maybe he was coached or guided or maybe if you want to go down the MK Ultra, because there are people that speculate that he was part of MK Ultra or MK or Project Monarch or something like that, which is mind-altering, so on and so forth.
Well, I just got into the chapter now. We're in Haight-Ashbury, and the author here is talking about, again, that before going to Haight-Ashbury, right, Manson was just a stinky pot-smoking hippie.
Right.
And after going they go to the Haight, now all of a sudden we're into acid. Now we're Jesus. Now we're this. Love There's it. Another book that Manson used to carry around. I forget the name of it. Stranger in a Strange World or something like that.
Yeah, interesting. I forgot that book.
And that book, there's I want to pick that up. I want to get the name again. But there's apparently there's tons of parallels to how Charlie saw himself and how the girls described him.
Do you remember any ties to The Catcher in the Rye in Manson?
Not so far. Are you talking about Chaos? You're talking about Helter Skelter?
No, I mean, so
just in the story.
So, I want to read that book. I didn't read it in high school, but
that's what we talked about before. I hate that book. It's boring shit.
Well, how about this? Let me give you a way to read it differently. Maybe. I don't mean to be pretentious. I just mean I just heard a conspiracy podcast the other day about it, and it's like there's so many people. I think there are. I forget now. I should probably.
Listen, the guy who tried to kill Jodie Foster, the Sirhan, who tried to kill.
They all had the book,
Robert,
right?
Kennedy. There was the one who tried to kill Jodie Foster, Sirhan. There's at least one other that professed after reading The Catcher in the Rye is why they did to try to murder somebody, so on.
Yeah,
so on.
Well, I heard a podcast, a conspiracy theory podcast, break Catcher in the Rye down. It's like, this may be a story about some guy going on a murder spree. And I was like, okay, if you read it like that, that's interesting. Anyway, so that was a curious thing. I don't know if that's a tie to Manson or not, but to me, there's a point where, I feel like the author's just trying to say, hey, what's going on with these anomalies? You know what I mean? Like, what's that? And so, to me, my super conspiracy brain goes to, all right, well, if they were, if that was the expressed or, understood intent was to create a race war, right? Well, that doesn't sound like too crazy idea. The things and they's may want to, you know, do at that time and place. Sure, you know what I'm saying? So, like, just, when you want to go with why or why.
Yeah, but I mean, like, the way Buglossi presents it for Helter Skelter, that doesn't make sense. Being
right.
Being protected, being an agent of, being a part of, again, protected on high. What we were saying offline a minute ago is it wasn't just Manson, though, that was protected. Sadie Atkins, she was on federal parole. Yeah. She was let go a couple times. And then, according to the author here, once she got with Charlie. Yeah. Like that level of fucking carte blanche protection, it was just exponentially increased. So she was already protected too.
Yeah, it was like,
and so it's
interesting.
Whoever's
in that circle, of.
Well, like who were they actually working for? Who was pulling what strings? Who was doing what? Because again, federal parole, and I do like it was chapter 8, I think is when it was. He was talking about Manson was on federal parole. If you talk about people that go to jail, right? Most people don't go to federal prison, and most people that go to jail don't come out on a federal parolee. Like a federal parolee, that's much stricter parole than regular fucking parole. And this guy was allowed to move.
Okay, you know that for a fact.
Yes.
Okay.
He was allowed to move. Not he was supposed to just be stuck to the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay.
How about this?
And he was able to move up and down all over California, New Mexico, you name it. And his parole was transferred without like the actual.
Yeah,
proper channels being followed according to the author, et cetera. So, I mean, simple things like that, but it's like these are things that normal people wouldn't have happened.
Well, how about this? There's an element of as you're reading the book, you're kind of going through the journey with the author, and he does a really good job of, like, going through the journey. But, like, there's a point where you're kind of questioning, like, oh, my God, what – like, your first thought is incompetence, right? Like, oh, my God, how did they miss this so many times? And then there's, like – you keep going. It's like, all right, like, man – incompetence is starting to not fit anymore, right? There's too many egregious examples of, you know what I mean? Like there's an, you know, like if a parolee is let off early, you know what I mean? And okay, how might that happen in a certain time and place? Well, like they exhibited remorse and change and so on and so forth, right? And it's like, okay, but how many five times after these egregious crimes you have to go, okay, man, who are you? Really, are you being fooled at this point, or like, you know what I mean? Now we're moving past incompetence to like complicit.
Well, just trying to understand, yeah, because one of the incidents which you're talking about there, Manson and the girls are arrested 3 days prior to the arrest. His parole officer, the one and only, Manson's his only parolee, by the way. His parole officer writes to the federal parole board that Manson, you know, he's making good progress, he's doing blah 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 blah, whatever. And he sends this in. 3 days prior to that, Manson was arrested for drug possession, narcotics, etc. The Sadie Atkins, she had her parole officer write something to the effect of how great she was doing. And then after she got arrested, he wrote saying he wanted her revoked. 3-4 days after that, she was taken off of federal parole anymore. She was released.
Yeah. What?
And it's like, wait, I'm sorry. She just, as your parole officer, I just said she's fucking up. And she just got arrested. Yeah. And I want her revoked. And instead, you, the judge. I said revoke parole, put her in prison. No, you erased parole. She's free.
Yeah.
What?
Into the parole. Yeah. So again, it's incompetence or complicity. You know what I mean? And I think the book, like, and the journey that he takes, like, he starts off with that. He's like, man, how many people messed up? You know, because there's an idea of like, man, this guy was on parole already. He's been in the system. Like, there's a, like, if anybody would raise their hand and said this guy should not be out, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like maybe none of this happens, right? And then it's like, all right, hold on.
Well, I agree, they're ample,
and like no right-minded human being in that role would otherwise make these decisions unless something. Right.
Unless
right?
somebody's pulling strings, and so what I was gonna say is I agree that I don't think that the author of this book was even remotely trying to he's not trying to blame, he's not trying to, he wasn't trying to actually contradict Helter Skelter.
Yeah.
What he was trying to do was write a piece for whatever 25th anniversary whatever, and starts asking questions of people that specifically, you know, cops that interviewed and so on and so on, and every step along the way, as he describes it, not only was he met with friction, he was met with fucking slam doors and hanging up and people that didn't want to talk about it, and when they would talk to him, they would tell him something that it sounded outlandish, and then they would pull out their bona fides, right, and show this.
Or it was contradictory to something they said here.
Right.
It's like, well, and you know, this time he said this, and they're like, oh yeah.
And then if he went back to him,
then the
whole thing was shut down. We never speak again.
Yeah.
And or a couple of them end up dying. And it's not, I'm not saying the connection, but it's like, dude, like this, it just has layers of, I'm asking questions. Mm-hmm. The more questions you ask, the more questions you find, and the more people no longer want to talk about it, and then that, it's that, just gone. The paperwork's
I think,
gone.
I think that value of those book is because it's presented like that. And to me, that's exactly what I need. I needed you to say, here's where I was. And like, you know, this journey of like, I was just asking this question. And, you know, the book opens with his interaction with Bugliosi. And, you know, it's like, if you start your interaction, your investigation like that, you know what I mean? Like with that contention and confrontation, it may make you like ask a bunch of questions.
Well, and then Bugliosi's funny. Like he was, along with the, we were on a flight a minute ago, Bugliosi did it. The other guy, what was the name of the one you said your chapter five you were talking about?
Terry Melcher.
Terry Melcher. So each of the initial interviews with our author of Chaos, yeah. Let's write my book together. Let's do my memoirs. Yeah. You be a part of that. And when he turns it down, then it's next thing is it's, then it's
yeah.
threats.
Yeah. If you
and,
ever, yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, as he tells you, he's, Bugliosi told him repeatedly, based in every interview, multiple tape recorders to record conversations, and he's like, you remember that I am the New York Times best-selling yeah, authority on the subject here, and blah, 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 blah,
I
blah.
I can make this easy for you. I can make this hard.
Right, and I can make like, this, and if you want to say anything about me, then we're going to go to court, and it's
you,
like,
when you hear that, it's like, okay, what are you hiding? That's, yeah. To me, that's the believable part. It's like, I just was going to ask questions, and you started going this route, and it's like, all right, well, that makes me ask more questions, and absolutely. You know, I highly recommend. We're gonna finish this book by the next week. But I don't know. It's been super interesting. You know, it's slightly conspiratorial, but it's done from the most like above board kind of approach. I think it's just a guy asking questions, and all the questions, brought him these new questions.
And then just the subject itself. Like I said, most people, if they do know anything of Manson, it's Helter Skelter.
To me, that's also purposeful, probably.
Sure. And I mean, that's what I knew of it. And when we first spoke about the book Chaos, you tell him that this guy. The way I heard it from you was, this guy's the authority, and he's telling you why this is all wrong. It's neither of those. What it is like you said. I believe this guy. He was trying to write a piece, you know, for the anniversary, and he had questions, and those questions led to more questions, which led to more questions, which led to inconsistencies, which led to more questions and more inconsistencies, and over and over and over. And as it was described by Bugliosi and Helter Skelter, is also very similar, and it's akin to when I think back of Bundy, when I think back of that time frame. Now, to give the grace as humans for the cops at the time, right? They did not have NCIC. They didn't have the computer program that overlapped. They didn't have everything fucking together where they communicated everything. Yeah. That being said, that is not an excuse for the amount of times, the sheer amount of times, the number of times. Hell, even the simplicity of this, the author again, he says one of the earliest times when Manson was arrested, one of the earliest times after being on federal parole, and we're talking like a week or so after getting out, they... Everybody's pointing fingers and asking, whose job is it to revoke him and send him back? Is that really a question? Again, we're not parole officers, but I assume it's a parole officer's job. However, like the whole court system, you're it's not like he's not in the system. It's not like they don't know this, right? So, how hard can it not be to do that?
Yeah, it kind of breaks down this idea of like, okay, incompetence or corruption. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it leans all corruption. Like I said, protected upon high somewhere.
Well, you start adding the things up, and it's like, man, there's, you know, incompetence.
Somebody was
like,
pulling strings somewhere.
No, like, nobody's this dumb, this many, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, that just doesn't fit. I think that's kind of my, that's, I think to me, that's the biggest takeaway from it as well, was that,
there's
corruption and there's ignorance. There's, you know,
I forget which detective he's talking to, but it was when they lived out at Spahn Ranch, and in the interview he tells, you know, he's reading his notes from the guy, and he says that the guy told him that his captain had told them that to leave Manson and the family alone, no matter what they did, leave him alone. And it was, this was after our authors hearing from other people like that Manson had threatened, not just. Like, he verbally threatened, he was on fucking recording threatening cops with rifles, and said, you come out here, we're going to kill y'all. You're a felon. You're a federal felon on parole who can't have guns, and you're, I mean, not only, all of that. And not only are you doing this, but the cops made a report of it, and they're told to leave you alone.
Right.
Where does that come from?
It's like, how does Waco and Manson happen, you know, whatever, 20 years apart, you know what I'm saying? Like, the complete hands off in this regard and the complete hands on the other one.
Sure.
I think that's super interesting book. Let's brighten the mood, okay? And that's I conned you. I don't know what I did, but I tricked you into watching a soccer documentary, kind of sort of, about Pulisic, and I kind of want to talk about.
By the way, he says tricked me. I was here for his birthday.
I forced him.
I was here for his birthday.
Twisted his arm.
And one of his birthday requests was to watch this thing. So it wasn't a trick. It was a birthday present.
Wow, it's so grandiose of you to watch a documentary about something that's interesting. But,
hey, well, you wanted me to praise it as you snuck, somehow snuck it by me and tricked
no,
me.
No, I was just I was teasing about that. But I don't know. Like,
I meant what I said.
For me, I've watched the show three times, but I kind of want to unpack it with you a little bit and like your thoughts, episode and a little bit into it. I'm a nerd on the subject, but like, what was your takeaway on the documentary Captain America?
Well, one, I had no idea who Christian Pulisic was.
Yeah.
And so I enjoyed the story, the backstory, and the information about him. The other part that stood out to me was, you know, we've talked many times when we go into sports, we talk about the athletes that shine, like the brightest star, the biggest stars on the biggest stages, right? The guys that step up
the
when
best
it,
the best, the great,
yeah,
the
when
great.
It, what when it matters, right? What makes you the fucking, what makes you the great? Is those that step up under pressure when the lights are the brightest. And this kid, you know, every one of the highlights I saw him, I was dumbfounded by the kid's control. His handles, which I know is not the right word for soccer, but the handles, the manipulation that he has with that fucking soccer ball, what he's able to do, how he's able to do it, and the different goals that I saw. Let's say I saw 10 of them. 8 of them were fucking finesse. And I mean, they were smooth finesse. And then there was a couple of just straight fucking howitzers. Blast that there's nobody going to stop it anyways. And so watching the juxtaposition of all those goals and just how he is and then adding on his age and how he handles himself. And I love, obviously, when we edit documentaries, there's the stupid word. Documentaries are obviously edited to tell a story however you want it.
Yeah.
And the early on was that the American football sucks. Who's on their team? They're terrible. Yeah. They're garbage. Blah, 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 blah. They're terrible. They're terrible. They suck. And then they start talking about Christian Pulisic. And all of a sudden, now we're edited to, you know, this guy's a beast. This guy's one of us. This guy's, you know.
Yeah, I think specifically when he goes to AC Milan, there's an element of, like, you know, the documentary shows, like, who's this guy? This is a mistake. And then he starts to show up, and he's like, oh, now he's our Captain America.
Yeah, now they embrace him all over, and they loved it. And,
yeah,
and
for me, like, maybe the reason I wanted you to see it or whatever, it's obviously it's a blind spot for you. And like, I don't want to say hyperbolic, like, comparisons in a way that's unfair to him. But, you know, I kind of described something, like, he's not quite the Michael Jordan of anything because he didn't have quite the accomplishments by way of like championships.
Sure.
But there is an element of him being the greatest. I mean, I think he's 25 now, 24, 25, somewhere in that range. And he's probably already the greatest American ever. And not only like on the field accomplishments, skills, so on and so forth, but like he's wearing the burden of the entire country, the entire soccer country on his back. And, you know, that kind of pressure on top of everything else, you know, the guy just produces. He had a weird run in Chelsea, but he's in AC Milan now, and he's crushing it. And it I don't know, the documentary does, I think, a fantastic job of, like, describing the humanity of a person who's relatively shy or relatively outside of the limelight. You know, like, there's an element that I think you and mine both respect, which is, like, the dude's a grinder. You know what I mean? Like, there's no accident. There's no, like, luck. None of that is part of his success. It is like the dude put his head down and just said, I'm going to be the best ever. And he even says that in one of the clips. He's like, I don't want to just be the best American. I want to be the best ever. And, like, what a crazy goal to have. And then, like, again, you get to back it up. You know what I mean? You get to get on the field and do it. And so, you know, the documentary is, like, it hits me in my feels. Because I've followed this guy for quite a while now. I told you once upon a time, like, you know, little kid, 10-year-old, 12-year-old Josh, or 12-year-old anybody in their backyard thinking about becoming a pro, right? Like, that kid, for me, Christian Pulisic is having the career that kid would have envisioned, right?
Sure.
Like you know, relative obscurity.
We talked about when he was dribbling just that day. Like, he was just telling, and, you know, his mom told a story that he'd go out there and he'd dribble the ball 500 times. He would do it 500, and he wasn't coming in until he did that.
Yeah.
That's the kind of grind we're talking about.
And it wasn't driven by mom and dad, who were both soccer players.
Like
they were like, come inside.
That was
like,
genetics,
no.
But they didn't, as it's presented at least, right? They're not out there encouraging or doing it. It's, they're not stopping him when he says he's going to do it, but they're not the ones saying, hey, let's go dribble the ball. He's doing it.
Ken Griffey Jr. has a huge advantage in the Major League Baseball because his dad played, right?
Sure.
But his dad never swung the bat for his son, right? He never made a play. You know what I'm saying? So, like, all that preparation and advantage and so on and so forth, sure, like, I won't denounce that, but, like, you still got to get out there.
Well,
and
genetics are great because, obviously, he's got good genes, but Tim Griffey's one of these guys, but genes are genes, but you still got to fucking work, and he's put in the work. That was the thing that I saw, at least, and again, we're only an episode in 5 minutes, whatever, in, but the amount of grind that I saw that kid put in, and, again, appreciating it's edited for it, but it is akin to the there's a level of work that is Jordan-esque, Kobe-esque. There's an amount of grind and just determination that I can see.
Yeah.
Is that, and again, like when they won that big game, everybody celebrating and he's going home.
Yeah.
It's we take care of business, we do our thing, and yeah, I mean he's impressive. He really is.
Tier in reading the game today, you know, big Arsenal fan. He's on the broadcast of CBS of this. He's like, it's a great win, but PSG next. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I'm thinking about this. And it's like, that's what you have to think about it. It's like, yeah, enjoy the moment, but, like, the mission's not done, you know? And the best of the best, the greats do that, right? My measure has always been, like, how you perform in the most critical moments. If you step up in championship games, you step up in the game you were watching was a derby in Milan, right? And that's one of the biggest stages you can play in. And to produce there is... Man, like, tip your hat to that. That's exactly what we want our greats doing, and you know, got an American doing that in a big stage.
Right, and it's big stage, big team. We're talking about championships, and again, that's why you're also not saying that, you know, Pulisic is Jordan, but there's Jordan-esque, right. And I wanted to, this just popped in my head because I told you yesterday I got down a down a rabbit hole of Jordan highlights on Instagram, and same for Larry Bird, and there was I don't know whose podcast I got a piece of or whatever. The guy's talking and he said, I want to ask it right out now. He said, at what point as fans did we actually start giving a fuck about the number of times somebody went to a championship? But started counting times you've been to the fucking title game. And he said, I'm going to answer here, is when LeBron started going. When LeBron started going, people were trying to talk about why he's so good, why he's the greatest, is because how many times he's fucking been there. It's not about titles, it's not about wins, but how many times you've been there? He's like, with love, that's fucking cute.
It's a team game.
And if getting there was all that counted, then, man, there's some fucking really amazing players out there. But winning them, that's what this kid hasn't won anything yet, but he's grinding, he's working towards it, and big plays and stuff.
I think he's Champions League. I don't know.
I'm saying.
Either way, I get what you're saying. I told you that he's probably the greatest American to ever play, and you're like, how and why? And you know, I turn on the documentary to kind of help explain that. But playing at the biggest level as he is and producing, you know, he's no other American's ever done what he's done. So it is. You know, it's not crazy to say he's the greatest American ever, even at this stage in his career. It's a great documentary. Go watch it.
Yeah, when I liked, obviously, you had Clint Dempsey, you had Alexi Lalas, you had a handful of other Americans on there too, and you know they're pretty much all on board too.
Yeah,
and then what's the guy? Yeah. What's the guy's Vladis Van? What's that guy name?
Zlatan.
That guy. Ibrahimovic.
Yeah.
Is it Ibrahimovic? Ibrahimovic.
I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That dude's a stud too.
Yeah. He's great. All right, let's wrap this thing up with. I sent the text to the boys today. I mean, it says, when you get older, nobody asks you anymore what your favorite dinosaur is. And I thought, you know what? Fuck that. Let's unpack our favorite dinosaurs before we get out of here. Favorite dinosaur and why, Mr. Nick?
Well, and as I said earlier, I said it for the longest time, it was T-Rex, right? And
why? Because it's the bad boy.
In all fairness, sure, it was the bad boy, but it was also like the big bad one that you know, the first one, the ones you learn about is the apex predator, if you will, right? And then when I learned about Velociraptors, I was like, ooh, because they're super fucking smart pack hunters.
Yep.
And then I also just like and laugh, but and I mean it too. Like, listen, I would go Raptor as my answer now.
I think so, yeah.
But followed closely by Dilophosaurus. Mm-hmm. Motherfucker that spits in your face.
Okay.
The hacks the loogie.
Oh. I said my favorite was Pterodactyl, and it is for the sole reason of...
Brooklyn.
Yeah. When Brooklyn's middle name, Thierry, we used to call her Brookie T forever and ever, and we used to come up with these like nicknames for what the T meant. She was Tarantula for a while. She was something. And then I don't know who said Pterodactyl. One of us did. And we all kind of stopped, said it and stopped and was like, close, but no. does not start with a T. That's not a brookie T.
Actually, I thought that the joke was that you said it, and then Gabby was like, "Dad, that doesn't start with a T."
That's probably how it went. Yeah. Probably how
it went. Because pterodactyl works
beautifully. Well, there was also an element of the reason I was saying it was because Brooklyn had a screech to her, and I was like, "You sound like a pterodactyl."
Well, dude, as you say that, when Gabriel was born, we had a fucking, actually, no, not Gabriel. It was Sarah, my younger sister Sarah. When she was a baby, she had a pterodactyl, pterodactyl.
Yeah, it made a noise.
And when you squeezed it, it was like, and it did this whatever weird ass fucking, what did you say she did? What was her sound?
I don't know, screech?
I don't know. It screeched. The pterodactyl doll that Sarah had, it screeched.
Sorry, Brooklyn. The best part of the story is that one of my kids told me the joke is like, I forget it now. It's why don't pterodactyls something
about going to the bathroom?
Yeah, because of the pee silent. Yeah, I forget the joke now, but that was part of the pterodactyl. I'm bombing the joke. Everybody's gonna listen
now,
to this going.
Now we end the podcast joke. On that.
That's it. Yeah,
the fucking just flop of a joke, Josh. Flopped.
It's okay, bro. We're gonna end the podcast on the flop of the joke.
We're speaking of flopping. We're watching soccer.
And Le Flop James. Man, you know what we did tonight? A podcast, and we kept it in an hour, nice and tight. We did a touch of conspiracy, lots of sports. You know, we're back in the groove, buddy.
Yes, sir. So, Joshua, what do you want to do on the next podcast?
That's
the
same thing we do every time, buddy.
What's that?
Try and take over the world.
Boom.
Your Highness, Secretary General, Your Majesties, Your Royal Highnesses, Presidents, Prime Ministers,